going to say one of the only people in the world. That's probably almost true, actually. There aren't so many. And Jonathan, we've gone through some of the questions involved in this inquiry previously, and I won't go through them again because I think Jonathan has he's got his foot in both camps. So, Jonathan is a student here, and is just working on his PhD on biology in modern science and notions of biology and nature in Hindu Puranic literature. So, is that kind of right?
Yeah, sounds about
right. Kind of right, okay. Go ahead.
Well, this is... maybe we could turn that light off now, yeah. I'll admit this is a presentation that I gave in Rome a few months ago. I didn't write all of this for today. Slightly revised it and updated it. And it was a conference about the origin of life. And they brought together theologians from all there's Jesuit priests there, and there was an imam, a Buddhist monk, and I was representing Vaishnava views, and then they had scientists as well, philosophers. So, but many of the same issues came up. So this is about looking for life. What is consciousness, East and West? And I think I started off again asking, who really cares? What's so what? I think it's one of the most important academic questions you can ask. A lot of times, we get involved in some particular textual tradition or a science or a philosophical school, but it's always good to sort of step back and say, well, who really cares? What's it really matter? And I think the origin of life and consciousness is one of those few questions that actually it does have a lot to do with the way we understand ourselves and who we really are. It has a deep impact on what we actually end up doing with our lives. So there's a lot at stake. And yeah, I think there's a lot of implications. There's political implications, scientific, theoretical, philosophical, theological implications. And all of these things I think are going to affect the quality of our life and the state we live in. And I'd like to begin by separating three different ways that we can discuss what is consciousness, what is life, and what is its origin. And the first one is what we might call the first historical instance of life on our planet. When and how did life come about? Yes? Sure.
Someone starts screaming. I sound a product to shut it off.
When and how did life first come about? Biologists are theorizing, was it 4 billion years ago that, and how did the chemicals combine in order to produce the first thing of life? They theorized about what was the components of the first living cell? How did RNA form, how did DNA form, how did life become self-replicating? It's still an open question. Scientists are trying to reproduce the early conditions of life. This is a replica of the famous Stanley Miller experiment done in the 60s, where they actually created RNA. This is what they think. There's some pool of water with nitrogen-rich pool of water. Electricity may have hit it through lightning, and that sparked off the first... It's a real Frankenstein story, actually. It sparked off the first instance of life. And they're still trying to figure out how did DNA form? How did life become self-replicated? It's a big question. It's not answered. Another sense of the origin of life is when things began at conception, when the sperm meets the egg, when a pollination occurs in a plant. What are the chemical and environmental conditions required to have a seed become living? Or this is a sperm meeting the egg. What happens there? Why does that happen? And the third instance, the third sense of the origin of life is what's going on at this very moment. How is an organism able to sustain its life and consciousness right now? How are we alive? How are we conscious right now? That's got to do with physiology. In different organisms, there's different processes that need to be happening in order to have it be a living organism. In regard to consciousness, scientists tend to locate consciousness in the brain. And what makes us conscious is something that goes on in the brain. That's where they've located the discussion about the origin of consciousness. One of the big questions there is, how do we get from light hitting the optic nerve or sensations hitting the olfactory gland and the tactile senses, how do we get from external stimulus hitting our body in some way to subjective awareness of the world? The problem of quality, it's called in philosophy of science. How does light hitting our eyeballs, going through the optic nerve and hitting a certain part of our brain, how does this give us a sense of form and color and depth and things like that? It's a big question that's totally unanswered as far as Western cognitive scientists are concerned. So now I'd like to go into one author who I think represents why they study consciousness the way they do, his argument for that. He says, miracles are naturally impossible events that require divine intervention and lie outside the laws of nature. So miracles are something that happen outside of nature and require divinity. To say life came about by a cause outside of nature is a miracle, a matter of faith, i.e. something one believes but cannot test. So to say life is non-physical or divine or spiritual or whatever you want to call it, it's something that one can only believe, something that's a miracle. The problem of the origin of life becomes a scientific quest when we make a testable hypothesis that life evolved on Earth from non-living chemicals. So we can only study something scientifically if and only if we assume it came from non-living chemicals. Thus, science deals entirely with principles of nature. Anything outside that is non-science or faith. This is from The History of Life by Richard Cohen. John Searle, who's quite a well-known Berkeley professor, we anticipated your lateness. UC Berkeley professor, he's quite well-known in the field of philosophy of mind, consciousness studies. He's one of a philosopher who scientists actually do listen to and take seriously. So, I guess it makes me a good philosopher. He writes, what exactly is the problem of consciousness, and how exactly do we suppose we can solve it? Our ultimate scientific objective is to find out how exactly the brain causes all of our conscious states, and where and how exactly those states exist and function in the brain. In other words, it's an a priori assumption that whatever consciousness is, it comes from the brain, and we can explain it eventually when we know enough about the brain through the functioning of the brain. And this is what we're doing, this is how we're going to proceed, this is what it means to study consciousness. Just as a side note, sort of a caveat, I don't think this view is, from my limited research of Christian theology and talking to Christian theologians, it's not a view that they find contentious. For them, aside from a small group of Christians who are influenced by Platonic thought, for them, pretty much consciousness is a material phenomenon. It comes from the body, it comes from the, now they talk about coming from the brain, but they have no problem with that. That's been part of their theology. It's part of Hebraic theology, Jewish theology. It was part of Aristotelian thought. So Hebraic and Aristotelian influences stress a psychosomatic unity, a unity between the mind and the body, between the soul and the body. Life and consciousness depend on the body and the brain. That's why they have a theology, for thousands of years, they have the theology of resurrection. We become reborn when our body actually reanimates. Its rebirth is actually when God brings the body back to life. It's rather, they bury bodies in many Christians still believe that. Some don't. Contemporary Christian theologian Arthur Peacock I've discussed this many times with his famous statement, humans are risen stardust. He has no problem with the idea that through evolution, stardust in non-living chemicals became human beings. It's, for him, it's traditional Christian theology. He's a canon of Anglican Church and a scientist. And we're going to get back to that at the end. So now I'd like to go into Vaishnava Hindu approaches to consciousness, and by doing that I'm going to focus on the Bhagavata Purana. This is a funny picture, actually. I found this in an old edition of the Bhagavata Purana, Sridhar Swami's commentary on it, and this is Parikshit Maharaj right here, who's a king speaking with Shukadeva Goswami. They're all dressed very nicely, but it actually says that Shukadeva Goswami was a wandering ascetic, only dressed by the four directions, his matted locks, his and they're sitting on, and Parikshit had been fasting, so, and they're sitting on the Ganga. The Bhagavata Purana is a conversation between a king and a sage about all sorts of things, theology, philosophy, politics, what we might call natural science. And so we're going to look at the Bhagavata Purana's views of consciousness, which is a central text for Vaishnava theology. We're going to look at Book 3, Chapter 26, Text 1 through 9, which is the beginning of an in-depth discussion on Vaishnava views of Samkhya, and other things are mixed in. Like I said, this is a summary of these 9 texts. It's paraphrasing. This view of consciousness is established on the basis of subjective first-person experience, Atma Darshan, and direct perceptual knowledge, anubhava or aparoksha. Consciousness is said to be in all living things, is beginningless, anadi, is without material qualities, niguna, it's beyond property, nor matter, material nature, possesses its own light, swayam jyoti. I was thinking about this term, swayam jyoti, and I think it could be in a modern context discussed as life is not carbon-based, right? We tend to think that whatever life is, it's carbon-based, and if there's life on other planets, it must be carbon-based. It must somehow be rooted in whatever matter is. The Bhagavata is saying that life, consciousness, has its own energy, independent of property, its own life.
What's the word for consciousness?
Purusha. Purusha is in this section. There's many, many different words, Atma, but Purusha, because it's in the context of a discussion in Samkhya, is mainly Purusha. But I think all of these words here are taken also to be synonyms or descriptions, because it's all a nominative case of synonyms of Purusha. As with in traditional Samkhya, matter and the mind, the manas and the buddhi, are seen to be ontologically distinct from the Purusha. Something that a major separation between Western Platonic dualism and Samkhya dualism is that for Plato, the mind was the self, whereas in this view, the mind is also, it's just as material. It's more subtle, but it's just as material as rocks and tables and computers. Nevertheless, matter itself is also described as daivam, divine, as a divine quality. And the Bhagavata goes into details about how matter is divine, and expressing the divinity of matter in different ways. Biological forms, the entire universe, the cosmos, are manifest through the divine play of God, Bhagavat Lila. And then, once the universe is being developed, pure consciousness enters, Purusha enters the natural world. It perceives Vilokya, perceives the world. And what happens is that its knowledge of its true identity as Purusha, as different from matter, is lost. Jnana Guhaya is the terminology. Jnana means knowledge, and Guhaya, it's covered over, hidden. So it's a perception of the world causes forgetfulness of one's real identity. I think this is something like what happens in a movie, you know, a good movie. You see the characters, essentially what you're seeing is flashing lights on a screen, quickly flashing lights, some colors, forms, and they're arranged in such a way that we can identify with them. And if it's a very good movie, the direction is good, then you perceive those lights and those forms and you forget about your own identity and you identify with the characters in the film. And you feel, even though it's just lights, you feel the emotions that are intended to be felt. For instance, if the woman's about to be stabbed, you feel tense and you get scared and you start sweating, and the couple fall in love and you feel happy and so on and so forth. And like I said, it's lights on a screen, but our identity as ontologically distinct from the lights becomes temporarily forgotten. So the text is talking about how this is happening on a much larger level, and there's a much more sophisticated apparatus behind it, God's intelligence, Maya, the bewildering factor of Maya, which is creating this illusion, this gigantic movie. This happens because consciousness falsely identifies abhidhyana with the actions of the natural world. So we have a body and mind, and we identify with that body and mind, and therefore the identity of the Purusha, which is distinct from the world, is forgotten. While material nature is operating, the consciousness comes to think itself as non-different from the body and mind. I put this up here for Sanskrit. I didn't include it in my original presentation, really, but I thought I'd doctor it up. And just, you know, I'm really pulling from the right stuff. So, the idea expressed, I think, in this particular text is that nature is going on while nature is going on. The self thinks itself as part of that nature. It thinks itself as part of the movie, essentially. Sridhar Swami, who's a seminal commentator, one of the first known commentators on this text, says that while this worldview comes from authoritative texts, it's Shastra Uktam, it's spoken in the Shastra, this knowledge is meant to mature into Vijnana, or realized knowledge, which one can apply to one's life. So it's the idea is that it's you learn from the text, but the text is there as a friend to assist one in having turning this theoretical knowledge into vijnana or realized knowledge, anubhava. Vijnana is often glossed as anubhava, or direct perception. A major analogy expressed all throughout the text, first time I think in detail is 291, is that this world is like a dream, and that without the deluding power of Maya, of Bhagavan's Maya, or God's deluding potency, then the existence of the dream will not be able to exist. So what's going on in the dream? There's a character, I think it's very similar to the movie analogy. There's a person here lying in a bed, and there's some images that we have in our subtle mind, in our mind, and we identify with those images, but we have an identity distinct from those images, and when the dream is over, we remember our real identity, and we go back to a regular life. And that's really the goal of the text, is to wake us up from the false illusion of this, of a true identity in this world. So some reflections on how this relates to modern consciousness studies and the origin of life. On this view, the origin of consciousness is both in this world is both a combination of biological form and the Purusha, which is distinct from biology, distinct from the mind. And so it's not saying that consciousness as a human phenomena is only transcendent, spiritual, it's only Purusha. Rather, it's, as a human phenomenon, it's a combination of both the body and brain and this pure consciousness. I think an interesting question would be, as science progresses and as we're able to create more sophisticated technologies, and we know the text talks about souls sort of being injected in material nature, could it be the case that we create artificial life form that a consciousness chooses to enter? In other words, a living organism. I think it's a question that's got to be thought about. Aside from the theory, I said it's meant to become vijnana or anubhava or direct perceptual knowledge. The Bhagavatam mainly is talking about a yoga practice, bhakti yoga. And I think this yoga can be investigated as a means of studying consciousness as a subjective phenomena. And without assuming a priori from the beginning that consciousness is merely a material phenomenon. And because the Bhagavata presents consciousness as both human or biological or dog consciousness, there's definitely the consciousness becomes mixed with the body, so it's not exclusive. It doesn't reject their darshan, their perspective on consciousness. It only says that there's more to the story. I'll get back to that later. This yoga practice has been tested and verified for thousands of years by contemplatives, by bhaktas, by sages of various sorts, and so within the tradition itself, it's to the practitioners who are part of it, it's been tried and shown true. But at the same time, I do think more that may be true. That may be true, but it could also be the case that more rigorous work could be done which utilizes the scientific method. In other words, science, I think, has developed very sophisticated methodology, an infrastructure for studying various sorts of phenomena. It hasn't really even tried to study subjective phenomena. When it has gone into psychology and sociology and consciousness, it's tried to reduce consciousness to an objective phenomenon, to call it objective, but it's really failed, actually. It's not working. And as if you were here last week, we heard Dr. Hafizi talking, sort of self-consciously saying that psychiatry is not a real science because it actually takes into consideration subjective phenomena, the patient's feelings, thoughts, reactions, emotions, and therefore it's not real science. I didn't push him on it, but you know, he's aware that anytime you talk about what a subject's perspective or the subjective, immediately it's considered not science. I think that's inherently contradictory, because science is a human phenomenon. It's only scientists who conceive of and understand a scientific theory. It's scientists who are sitting in their laboratory who subjectively, in their own minds and consciousness, develop a theory, a hypothesis, and then test it. And it's other scientists who intersubjectively understand it. So science is not it may be studying things outside of them. It's a debate. But it's an intersubjective process. They're still realizing and understanding those scientific theories among themselves, intersubjectively. Some steps forward. What could be... So I've said that science is focused on objective, the study of objective phenomena, the study of consciousness as an objective phenomenon, whereas the Bhagavata, and I think all of the Indian traditions that we're going to go into, Advaita Vedanta, Buddhism, Shaivism, I think they've all developed their own unique paths for studying consciousness as a subjective phenomenon. How can this be studied further? I think one thing that has to be cleared is the biases of materialism, of objectivism. And I think they come originally from Christian theology, that, like I said, consciousness is a material phenomenon. So it was part of the theology which early scientists were part of and born into. And science is now more or less canonized that view, and is totally entrenched in that, and is not even willing or able to step outside of that worldview. So that's, I think it's a theoretical block that needs to be cleared, first of all. Secondly, we have to rethink what is the scientific method. There's a number of Buddhist scholars who I think have done excellent work on this, Alan Wallace. I didn't get a chance to talk about today, but I think he's done a lot of work in reconceiving what the scientific method is, so as to include subjective phenomena, i.e. consciousness. And I don't think this is really that strange to propose a new scientific method. It's not historically unprecedented. There are different methodologies for physics as opposed to biology. There's different criterion of judgment. Up until the 1960s, philosophy of science was primarily philosophy of physics. But around the 1960s, philosophers turned their eyes towards biology and realized all these old methods, the hypodeductive method and logical positivism, and all the theories of what science is didn't apply so cleanly to biology. And so they had to rethink the whole philosophy of science in light of biology. And they came up with new theories of what science is. The likelihood hypothesis is something that's quite well accepted. That's what's going on in biology. It's a whole discussion in itself. But my point is that there are different methodologies already for physics and biology. And even within physics, there's slightly different methodologies for quantum mechanics and for relativity theory and for classical mechanics. So what are some steps forward? I think one way is to, this is really pulling from this scholar Alan Wallace, Buddhist scholar Alan Wallace, that we have to start thinking of science as an empirical and rational analysis of the contents of intersubjective consciousness. What are we all experiencing intersubjectively? Supposedly, we're all having a similar sort of experience right now, and when it's over, we'll be able to talk about it. Slightly different perspectives and things like that, but essentially there's some core elements that are the same. And the Bhagavata is a tradition which employs a methodology for studying consciousness. And I think it also is needed as a thoroughgoing critique of Cohen's and Searle's assumption that really only a non-physical conception of life can be done in science. Again, that rests on a definition of science and everything like that. Some questions. Do the materialistic, biases and metaphysical biases of modern science separate it as its own religion? Has neurobiology and that train of thought in the study of consciousness, has it become its own religious discipline because it has these metaphysical biases? Oops. At the same time, as I said, the Bhagavata, I don't think it would reject their perspective on consciousness. It would just say that there are other avenues of ways, and different avenues and different ways that we can go about studying it. Nevertheless, what can the Indian traditions learn from neurobiology about consciousness? And they all invariably focus on consciousness. And vice versa, what can the two traditions learn from each other? And lastly, what does contemporary science have to learn from Indian tradition? Okay, I wonder about, you know, what is it, what it, what can be learned from each other? I think that's where the starting ground of a dialogue begins. Yeah, I'll just conclude with that, how I started when we first started that movie that I had seen, that at one point there's a patient who's with her psychologist, and the patient says she's being attacked by ghosts, and she's being cut up by this ghost, and she's not really hurting herself, but this demon sort of thing is attacking her, and the psychiatrist just thinks she's crazy, and that ghosts aren't real, and that whatever her problem is, it couldn't be what she's saying it is. And the psychiatrist says to her, "I want to help you, but you have to trust me." And the patient says, "Well, how can I trust you if you think I'm crazy?" And the point being that unless you accept my reality as real, then there can't be any real constructive dialogue between us. As the movie develops, the psychiatrist gets attacked by the same ghost, and then she's on the other side of the table being treated by her peers, her colleagues, and they're saying the exact, she has basically the exact same conversation with her colleagues. I'm not saying ghosts are real or anything, I'm just saying that in order for an East-West dialogue to really happen, there has to be some acceptance of the validity of the other person's darshan, their perspective on reality. And that's, I think, everything. Yeah, like I said, these are seminars which are intended to generate discussion, and so I'd like to turn the lights on and open it up for discussion.
Can I play chairperson and say thank you very, very much?
Oh, sure.
That was really, really interesting. And then can I play chairperson and abuse my tenuous power as the chairman to ask
sure.
that question? I'm really interested in your initial part where you're trying to look at what the notion of consciousness is, like the different ways of defining it. And we talked about, and you started off actually with consciousness as the source of life, rather than mind. And that's reflected, as you say, in the Bhagavata Purana account. I'm kind of curious, partly the tedious question of what we're calling consciousness here, and also the problem that always comes up with dualistic notions, matter, consciousness, matter mind, matter spirit, about how blunt an idea of consciousness we're coming up with, how naive, in a sense. So I guess part of the question is, you talked about in the Bhagavata Purana's philosophy, which is very Sankhya, mind is part of matter. All these forms, the shapes, these concrete, finite aspects of existence, that's part of the worldly part.
Yeah.
Consciousness is more to do with what makes the forms alive.
Animate
in some sense. But part of then what you can't help wondering, you talk about having a methodology for studying consciousness, but mind is the matter part. It's not the mind and the shapes and the ideas and the forms you'd be studying, because that's the matter. And the kind of consciousness you're talking about is something a little more lucid, about which is harder to talk about content in some sense. So I'm kind of curious about how that method, how that notion of consciousness will work, where maybe consciousness purusha might be spirit, might be, you know what I mean? Consciousness is an interesting translation. And what kind of methodology you have that would be studying the consciousness and not the manas, if you see what I mean.
Good question.
Sorry.
It's the heart of the matter. I mean, consciousness could be just defined as awareness. Or could be defined as anything living. I think the Bhagavata was saying anything that's alive is conscious, although it may not be aware in the same way that we're aware, because we have different coverings. The bodies are different, therefore the minds are different, and therefore the amount of awareness is different. But anything, just definitional issues, anything that's alive is a purusha. And then how do you define life? That's also, how do you determine something's alive?
is an issue. Scientists have, biologists have their own ways of determining living from non-living.
Mm.
It's got to do with reproduction, metabolic processes, some ability to interact with the environment. I think a lot of those things would apply as well to this.
It's interesting, it sounds very Aristotelian in a way, the definition of consciousness in this case, where it's about change and movement,
yeah.
Animation,
yeah.
Development,
definitely.
The ability to not just be inert, but
yeah.
to have a sort of growing, changing, formal kind of
right.
Energy.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And in regard to your second point, it seemed like you're saying, okay, if we want to have means for studying consciousness, but the mind, that would exclude studying the mind. So how do you then study something if you're not involving the mind? Is that almost what you're saying?
Yeah,
I think that's a good question. One thing to remember is that on this view, at least, consciousness has its own awareness. It has its own mind, essentially. That's one point. Another point is that the mind can be used to reflect upon consciousness. I think that's another view that gets expressed a number of times throughout the Bhagavatam, is that when the mind itself is purified through various means, then it becomes a tool for studying, for turning in on the Purusha. I could go into later Chaitanya Vaishnavism, and there's the first verse of the Shaktastikam, which is the only teachings that Sri Chaitanya gave directly, left directly behind. And there is this notion of when the mind is pure, then it becomes a useful tool, a mirror for reflecting consciousness, and that the problem is that the mirror right now, the mind, is impure, and that when we purify it, then it will reflect the existence of consciousness properly, truly.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you're bringing up the exact same thing that Kant brought up, actually, in the notion. Yeah. I mean, his point was that if there is this transcendent, he did believe in a transcendent, they called it the transcendental apperception.
Mm-hmm.
How do you get to that? You can't, he said, because every time you try and think about it, perceive it, you brought it into the categories, into the judgment forms, and his whole epistemological apparatus, which contaminated it, and so therefore it's not the thing in itself, it's the self contaminated by the pure forms and by the forms and judgment categories and all that stuff.
So is consciousness
yes.
beyond language?
Yeah, I mean, these are all language, these are all like Kantian questions. I guess it depends. I don't know, I think that's for everybody here to answer for themselves, but I would say it depends on what your understanding of the words in the sentence are. You know? Everything is beyond language unless you understand the words properly and fully. Did you enjoy your coffee? Is incomprehensible to someone that's never tasted coffee. But it is comprehensible to people that live.
That sounds like something in the Christian tradition.
Okay.
St. Augustine or St. Bernard talking about the consciousness of God. And it seems to me that your initial contrast between Western theological perceptions and Eastern doesn't really match my understanding of things.
Okay.
It seems to me that Christian religious tradition, presumably the Islamic tradition also, are aware of the divine consciousness beyond and yet within.
Even as the self? I mean, are there Christian traditions that really argue that the self, I mean us as individual souls, are ontologically distinct from both from the body and the mind, or at least the body?
There is certainly the idea of the divine image in that, which is separate from our ordinary material consciousness and day-to-day experience.
Can exist without the body?
But can exist without. It might exist. In God, it can exist.
Okay.
And in life in general, it is all pervasive without being identical.
Okay.
The physical resurrection theology has gone through a bit of a renaissance recently amongst theologians, and I think it's partly, I don't think they would say this themselves, but I think it's an apologetics to science. And I was interested that your canon that you quoted is also a scientist, and I think there's a great deal of, I think there are a lot of attempts amongst Christian communities at the moment to kind of reconcile themselves with the findings of materialist science. And I think they're terribly mistaken in that quest. But it wasn't around, for example, in the 19th century in popular consciousness or in sort of Christian theologians. I think there's a kind of irony to this as well, which is that the Stardust image, I think, is an attempt to overcome a matter of spirit duality that is seen as unhelpful. But, I think that doesn't really work either. But I think that this duality, that you were describing another kind of duality, you've got your matter, mind, entity, and you've got consciousness, which is either opposed to or I tend to think it's sort of embracing a smaller entity. But I think that was around, actually. I think that was a much more popular model in the 19th century.
Okay, I'd like to check that out.
Well, I think right from
you go back to the Gospel of John,
and
it's very spirit based. Then it becomes Gnosticism, and it's turned into a heresy, and it's excluded from the mainstream.
Yeah, like I said, this view came from a number of conversations with Arthur Peacock.
Oh, yes.
And I know he's got his. Yeah, right. But no, but he's also a historian of the church. I mean, he knows. He's a canon. He knows. Church history. No, I understand he's in his own field.
I think he's one voice in that conversation.
Okay.
I may mistake if I say that Christianity privileges human beings, that only human beings have the privilege of consciousness, they have the privilege to have soul, and they reject the world of animals or to moral war. Whether I think Islam is very close to Hinduism in a way that soul and consciousness exist under the little ants, animals, they are not outside our world, that we are not privileged. So every creature is a privilege of the act of God somehow. I come from the scientific extreme of your work, when you talk about the origin of life, of consciousness, can't we say that consciousness emerged at the moment when matter organized itself and became, developed self? When matter, at the level of DNA or whatever, start to communicate with its environment. And this, at this level, we are dealing with consciousness. Because there is self is the fundamental core of consciousness. It's not something which is just proper to the brain. The brain is a very advanced stage. So something happened even up there in the cosmos. And we are dealing with self and consciousness at this level. Is there any argument in the Hindu tradition? Because I come from this understanding from cosmology. That is there something in Hindu tradition that insinuates that there is something on cosmical level which make matter already give matter is talked about, and the devil of itself, the conscious of itself, or being aware of something. I imagine for me, I believe that a virus which is flying out of space is aware, has and be a kind of awareness, because virus can scan the algorithm,
sure,
and react to it.
Yeah.
Okay. Accept and, I mean, develop strategies, yes, to survive. So this is awareness. So there's something very fundamental in what you could call consciousness, or it is something that all just cognitive somehow.
Do you want to comment on that?
Yeah, just
you can turn that off, actually.
There is something of what you're talking about. There's in Sankhya, there's the Purusha and the Prakriti. And in Vaishnava tradition, those are appropriated, those concepts, and then put together. So that the Purusha, at the earliest time of creation, basically glances or energizes this Prakriti and brings activity into what is inert matter. Kind of, you can say, gives it it gives it a conscious feel, you know? Even though the matter is inert, but it appears conscious. Now, this process brings about the existence of what's called ahankar, which I think is the closest thing to what you're talking about, because aham means I, and kara means maker, the I maker, or, you know, it creates the sense of I, who I am. Now, this idea of self, that this is who I am. Now, this is something that every conscious entity has, is this ahankar. Now, according to the Hindu tradition, this concept of ahankar is mistaken, because it is a result of appropriation from the realm of matter into the realm of spirit. And so it's something that must be gotten rid of. But one could say that the scientific viewpoint that you're describing is one way to look at it from a Hindu perspective, say that you are describing the ahankar, not the pure conscious self, not the Atman, or not the Nirguna, the one that we got the list of qualities, but you're describing ahankar. So in that sense, then, describing it as you describe it, it's something that's a product of matter at a certain point in creation, not at the brain level, but a much earlier level. That's fine, as long as you describe that as ahankara and not as the purusha or as the atma. Right? So that, what I mean to say is, there is a place where Hindus would say, yeah, that's fine, if you take the Sankhya view and then use that at a secondary level of ahankar. The point, I think, what Jonathan's been describing is, it's beyond that, there's the purusha, and this is where it gets difficult, because the purusha, being free of mind and of intelligence and different manas and buddhi and all the sort of what we use to cognize the world, it becomes very difficult to study this thing. This is what Jessica's bringing up. And I think, I mean, I personally feel that the only way of really getting at it would be then to turn to the yogic processes that Jonathan had mentioned, which is basically a stripping away of these categories. And because, I mean, that's a fundamental question that has been asked over and over in the tradition, is, okay, how can we conceive or perceive something, study something, which is beyond all categories, you know, which we cannot understand? And that's become the question of epistemologies. Well, there's three ways of knowing: pratyaksha, anumana, and shabda. And the idea being, you cannot know it by sense perception or by inference, but only through the yoga process of, first by receiving the knowledge, and by then experiencing it through vijnana, as Jonathan was saying. So it is, I mean, I think the tradition, at least parts of the tradition, would agree that, yes, it is difficult to study this the way we study things here. What we end up dealing with in science is more ahankar and not really the pure purusha, which
yes,
is very separate.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Just to clarify, when these Vaishnava materials adopt Sankhya categories, to what extent are they changing the Sankhya vision of things, or are they? Do they adopt it wholesale, or... is there some substantial
difference? I haven't gone into a tremendous amount of study comparing like the Sankhya-Karikas or the Sankhya Sutras with the Bhagavatam, but I think I have gone into it a little bit, and many of the categories are the same. I mean, it's there's the Mahat, the Ahamkara, the different Mahabhutas, the Tanmatras, all these basic categories are the same. I mean, I don't know if it means anything to most people here, but I don't even know how to translate most of them. But I think the basic categories are the same. It's the definition of what Purusha is, the multiplicity of Purushas, the Purusha's relationship with Parampurusha, with Bhagavan. That's different than when you get, in other words, the soul's relationship, the individual self's relationship with God. That's different than what you get in the Sankhya Karikas or the Sankhya Sutras. Although I did read a good article just recently, where it's written in the 20s by an Indian scholar, where he actually shows a number of the exact verses from the Sankhya Sutras, which is one Sankhya text, are the exact same in the Bhagavata. He just lined them up one side of the page and the other, and it's the exact same terminology. Some very minor differences. So there's definitely some dialogue there. Chance would rule out that it's just they happen to use the same words in the same order. But definitely the interpretation is different. Yeah.
One reason I ask is because I'm not aware in the Sankhya sources if it says this thing about Purusha being the same in all of it. I mean, where do you draw that line in the Vaishnava materials in terms of does a tree have a Purusha? I mean, it doesn't quite seem to gel with the Sankhya view on things in the sense that like Jerry Larson offers the translation pure contentless consciousness for Purusha. That is to say, what the Purusha actually is
in itself. So
it's a meta awareness. The capacity for being aware of the contents of the mind and all other phenomena.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that both cognitions and materialistic phenomena are both in the same category of things that are observed by consciousness. And in the absence of any phenomena, that consciousness is still present.
Yeah.
I mean, it doesn't seem to me to describe an animal or a vegetable experience.
No,
certainly
it doesn't.
In the Indian tradition, there is a privileging of a human being above all these other species in that capacity to actually just
inquire,
dwell in the state of the pure consciousness.
Yeah.
As there is in Islam.
Yeah.
Mm.
I think
it's bigger, but I talk about unity.
No, go ahead, sorry.
Because, for instance, you find this Anant, which meets King Solomon and prevent him from what's going to happen to him. So this power, if there's any revelation, I mean, this the world of animal has access to the world of revelation and even can reveal things to prophets and kings.
Mm.
Mm.
So it's in this way that I'm talking about this.
In my understanding, and correct me if I'm wrong, is that really a human being in Islam only truly becomes a human being in its orientation towards God. That is the understanding of what it is to be human. Now, actually, in some ways, that seems remarkably close to what you were just describing as a kind of meta-consciousness, in fact.
Yeah, you are right in what you are saying. Okay, you have to put all the pieces of the puzzle together. So it's true that only those who can face the path, the light of God, who are elevated to upper level of beings. But it does mean that this path is excluding others, but the way is open. So does mean that animals are low level or degraded or whatever. There is a sense of value, although the contact with God is privileged contact. There is a sense of value of the world of other beings as well.
Isn't it, I mean, to some extent it's true, isn't it, that there are more dualistic and more pantheistic elements in all of these traditions, 1, 2, 3, 4 traditions. And so you can kind of play it in almost every direction, and that there is a more emanationist Islam, for which the ant reflects God's essence, just as the human reflects God's essence, although because the human can make not nice pictures, that's a bad idea, but can do things that the ant can do. The human has a greater capacity to reflect aspects of God's great consciousness. It's not an ontological distinction, if you see what I mean. He's just, as it were, as Ibn Arabi might put it, a better jewel, a better mirror, which can reflect more facets, as it were. And it seems to me that is also...
I think that's what's happening in Sankhya. I mean, even in the Sankhya Karikas, and I can't think of any a verse directly out of the Sankhya Karikas or the Sankhya Sutras, but definitely in the Bhagavata, that's the idea, that it's this pure consciousness, Purusha, has all these qualities that you mentioned. It's identifying with various forms, definitely in the Bhagavatam, and it's incarnating in these various forms according to its deeds, its karma. And it may be in an ant, identifying with an ant form, and therefore have practically no ability of self-reflection, ability to think philosophically, or plants may not even have a mind at all. It's covered by various, or it's identifying with various bodies, which give it various levels of capacity and ability to access its true nature.
It seems to me you get exactly the same thing in Islam. If you read Ibn Arabi's Fusul Hikam, for instance, the Bezels of Wisdom, the same image of the jewel, in which you can have the settings of the jewels of wisdom, each different prophet at a lower level, each different person at a lower level, each different creature at a lower level, each instance of God's creation is a reflecting jewel of a different
capacity. The great chain of being is also this hierarchy of
In Bhagavad Gita you have the analogy of different types of covering, there's fire covered by smoke. And the mirror covered by dust, and the embryo covered by the womb. And its commentators point out that the embryo covered by the womb is animal species lower than human species, where it's so covered that the presence of the deity or the atman is not, the conscious element is barely visible. And then with the others you have the human, and then you have more enlightened or higher species, which is very much covering just like smoke on fire. It's there, but it sort of goes away on its own.
Is that also an Advaita Vedanta? I would assume that this Purusha, we were discussing that a few nights ago. That
some of the other empirical level definitely is there.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I had a question concerning what you said about the need to reform or to rethink the scientific method.
That's what started this whole thing.
And from what I've been hearing, we definitely, and I would like to know what you intend by that, because it seems to be very needed. After hearing also what you said about the Amkara, that basically what we have at our disposal and what science really acknowledges as valid means of knowledge are basically not valid means of knowledge, because the Purusha is way beyond our means of knowledge. So if we are here to try to bridge science and Indian tradition, how do you intend to do that?
Yeah, I think that's the heart of the question. That's why we originally
did you have
thought
an insight into
this whole seminar.
You did mention something that actually got my attention. You mentioned what we do experience you mentioned intersubjectively?
Intersubjectively. This is
Alan
Wallace.
What did you mean by that? Because it was quite actually interesting.
Well, first, just to why it's out of my mind, I think science always has progressed by introducing unobservables, theoretical entities which they're not able to observe presently, but they help explain the data, and therefore we're going to introduce them and hope to see them later. The atom was an unobservable entity for a long, long time. They didn't, I think they perceived the atom in like the 1970s, but for a long time before that, it was just a theoretical, unobservable, an O term. And they introduced it because it helped explain data. The electron is still an unobservable entity. We can observe it going, I mean, you would know more about this than I do, but it's just been introduced because it's a useful theoretical tool to explain data. Heredity was like that for a long time up until really when they really started to understand the DNA in the 1960s, Crick and Watson. But up until that time, they didn't really have any understanding of how it was that children looked like their parents. It was just assumed that there was some mechanism that there was the case, and it was a fundamental element of Darwin's theory that there is a heredity principle. And it was just assumed until, like I said, 1963 when Francis Crick published their famous paper on DNA. So I think one contribution that the Indian traditions can make is it has all these theoretical entities, Ahamkara, Purusha, Mahat, Manas. They don't even really, there isn't really a conception of Manas in Western science. They try to just pretend that mind is not really there, or that, what's the famous line by, I can't remember his name, but Herschel, he was one of Darwin's first disciples, really, he was really a disciple, and he said that the mind exudes consciousness the way the liver exudes bile. So it's and so what kind of a conception of the mind is that? It's that can be looked at and rethought, I think, and Indian traditions all have very developed functional different functions of different parts of the mind and how different emotions lead to different types of consciousness and the relationship of even diet and consciousness and one's living environment and clothes, everything. So there's all these things I think could be introduced. And like I said, it's not unorthodox science, historically speaking. Right now, the big thing is dark matter. I just read somewhere that they think now it's like 70% of the universe is dark matter, which is this imperceivable stuff that's, because they need it to account for gravity.
90%?
It's worse. So they need stuff which they haven't been able to perceive to account for gravity. And so they've introduced dark matter. And
dark energy is an even more worse concept.
Huh. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Well, I agree with you that science is based on a lot of subjectivity, or even some state which are not physically or scientifically tested, or proved somehow. Like the concept of wave function in quantum mechanics is an abstract concept which just abstract concept, but it turns out that this purely subjective abstract concept becomes a representation of reality. So where is objectivity? Where is subjectivity in science? So the line is not sharp somehow. Mm-hmm. And I agree with you. I mean, with your conclusion, I think in every tradition there is, we feel there is sense of truth, and at some point there is divergence.
Mm.
So, which means that we have to get together to speak and understand what's going on.
Yeah.
Like the example of your psychoanalyst, as you said.
Mm.
And it brings me, for me, I mean, the question, is this situation kind of expression of the reality of what's going on in the world, or is it just the problem of our method? I mean, the way we define things, the way we set up our methodology is somehow misleading us in our investigation. So because I felt, for instance, in the Hindu tradition, there is some kind of softening which touches what I think is the reality, and then it diverges. In Christianity, there is touch of what is the physicality of the world, and then there is this divergence. So we, is it problem of method, or is it problem of the brain, which is stubborn somehow, or what? What's going on? I mean,
Yeah, I think Chris is dying to say something.
Well, dying.
I think it's Herschel.
Kind of, yeah, but it really
90% sort
of typifies the huge dichotomy between Eastern and Western views on the issue. And what's interesting is that both are neither proved nor provable, probably. Because basically, most cognitive scientists and neurologists that I've spoken to definitely characterize consciousness as an epiphenomenon of the brain.
Right, yeah.
And whereas, you know, in at least some of these Eastern philosophical disciplines, matter, indeed the entire universe, is an epiphenomenon of consciousness.
Yeah.
And,
sorry.
With the science, well,
okay.
is in my in my Shaivism talk.
Okay.
That would definitely be the case. And there's more to it than that, but it's interesting that in Western science, of course, that is a axiom that has not been proven and is still just assumed. And, you know, cognitive scientists like Steven Pinker say that, he likes to say that consciousness is still a mystery wrapped inside of a riddle, wrapped inside of an enigma. We still don't understand, if it is an epiphenomenon of the brain, exactly by what mechanism or by what process it's generated, you know, where is the chemical reaction that we can point to and say, ah, there is consciousness.
Right.
It hasn't been found, you know. And so what's interesting to me is the perspective, for example, of Sankhya, which is so kind of bizarre from a Western point of view, in the sense that they're making this division between cognition and one's awareness of one's cognitions, and that the two, to us, seem very wrapped up together.
Right.
But for them, that wrapped up in this is indeed the whole problem.
Right.
And that the real fact of the matter is that consciousness is this a priori principle which is utterly transcendent of and ultimately unrelated to the chemical reactions that cognitions are manifestations of. And it seems to me that kind of statement is sufficiently bizarre that it only could have come from meditative disciplines and a kind of meditative experience whereby this perspective is teased out.
I totally agree. That's getting back to Jean-Marie's question. There is two points I was going to make. One is introducing unobservables, and the other is introducing communities of people who have intersubjective awareness of these same things which are unobservable to the rest of the population. I'll unpack that just quickly. And basically, it's science itself right now is not really what it promises to be. It says it, and anybody can verify anything. It doesn't really work that way, actually. I mean, there's tight-knit communities of scholars and scientists who know what they're talking about with each other, but to try to explain it to anybody else, they can't do it. I mean, I think I've mentioned this before, but I had a number of conversations with biologists, and I know for a fact that if somebody is in the field of genetics, they may know nothing of geology, although they may depend on a geologist in order to construct phylogenetic tree or like how evolutionary things have progressed. My point is that there are already scientific communities, so they have developed over time their knowledge such that they can talk to each other meaningfully, but there are people outside that discourse who they can't talk meaningfully with. All you have to do is go to a scientific conference or try and read something from a journal and you'll know right away, I have absolutely no idea what they're talking about. It's the same, you go to a Sanskrit class and if you don't know Sanskrit, it's meaningless to you. Or Greek, it's Greek to you. another thing that can be introduced, I think, to it, is introducing communities of Vaishnavas, of Shaivites, of traditional Sankhins, of whatever, who've unwrapped, so to speak, consciousness from the mind and are able to talk about with each other meaningfully, you know, the difference between Buddhi, Manas, and Purusha with each other, but that may not be meaningful to other people. But I think that's just the way the world works.
I'm just thinking, wouldn't that involve simply replacing one elitist community by another?
Yeah.
And again, where is science in the radical sense of the term?
It doesn't work that way. I mean, I think that's... Yeah.
So if we have to renounce that. No, it's not for everybody. Just the elite, right? People who actually are really...
Have you ever tried to do, like, quantum mechanics? Have you ever tried to figure out what's actually going on in a cell? I mean,
see, but that's
take you.
This is the subject matter is very different because if we're talking about consciousness, if you're talking about intersubjectivity, this is it. This is I. Everybody is aware here and now. We can all attest of that.
Yeah.
It's not like not everybody can attest of the presence of, you know, protons and electrons and things
but
like that. Of course,
we may not have learned the maths we need to study quantum physics, and we may not have learned the mental tools we need, which are apparently quite difficult, subtle tools, perhaps gained only through practice, that we require in order to study. I agree with you, but
and
I
practice
think
involves, again, where you have to appeal to some extraordinary experience, some yogic practice leading to some yogic insight. Then you will know what I know. But then this is where it's at today. This is the yogic tradition. You know, it's only for a few people, and that's why scientists reject it altogether. You know, this is for mystics. We're not dealing with mystics. We're going back
to
mysticism.
But science is just as mystical in that sense. I mean,
yeah, for the mass of people, certainly it is.
Yeah.
It makes these dogmatic assertions, which most people can't verify.
No hope of verifying.
Anyway.
Yeah.
A friend of mine was ridiculed back in high school when she decided not to believe in the atom. It wasn't a datum of her experience. Nobody had ever been able to prove it to her. So she decided the atom doesn't exist.
I'd like to shake her hand.
I mean,
my father was a physicist, and his experiments notoriously never worked in demonstration classes. What can I tell you? I mean, you know...
The difference, I think the rub is that scientists want to say it's in principle verifiable. Okay, you may have to go and do 12 years of maths in order to understand what's going on in the theory of relativity. Now, we'll say that, you know. They'll just say, you start taking math and call me in 10 years or whatever. And they will say that. But they would say that it's in principle verifiable, you know, assuming... You have the determination, a certain level of intelligence. You'll be able to understand these things in time.
It's also falsifiable insofar as it'll make specific predictions.
Mm-hmm. That's true.
And I mean, you've been talking about verification, but not at all about falsification. I think, particularly if you're dealing with qualia,
that's a good point.
I'm not sure what kind of methodology really, as Jean-Marie asks, I mean, we would really be looking at here.
Well,
neither am I.
It's
I think
true it's that the elite of mystics in the Indian tradition certainly is analogous to this elite of scientists because they say, look, go and do these practices for 12 years and you'll get not these exact results perhaps, but somewhere in this range of results.
It'll make sense to you.
Your
yeah,
results
some
will
level
lie. And, I mean, it depends on what the proposition trying to be demonstrated is. I mean, obviously that's not necessary if you're trying to demonstrate there is consciousness, because like Jean-Louis says, that's an immediate that's the basis on which we're having this conversation in the first place. But if your contention is like the Sankhya one, that you can exist, that consciousness is not dependent on its contents, that is to say consciousness can exist without an object, that's only verifiable clearly by removing the contents, removing the objects from consciousness and seeing if you're still aware. And that is something that takes practice, possibly for 2 years.
Everybody experiences non-awareness, even though that's something, I guess you define consciousness as awareness. I'd say, how about everybody's experience when times when they're not aware of anything? And I don't think that requires practice at all.
No, but that's not
everybody
what
knows what not being aware means.
I know, but I'm talking about being aware without any contents of consciousness. Pure contentless consciousness.
Can I just
Jessica's
interject and say,
she's dying.
As a philosopher, in with my philosopher's hat, because I sound totally crazy. And
we are.
I mean, no, that's right. But I mean, again, you know, you talk about times when we're not aware. What about our consciousness when we're not aware? What kind of thing are you talking about?
I was just picking up on his definition of...
What kind of thing are you talking about?
Consciousness as awareness.
It's awareness.
Consciousness,
you define
when you're
consciousness
not aware.
Is awareness. I'm saying, I think pretty much everyone's experience can testify
yes.
to something different, which is, isn't it?
Like when? Sleep? Is that really
when coma, sleep, anybody
but
knocked
but
you on the head and you had for a while.
But then
that's not aware. You're not aware of anything then, right? So
I
then
think
what happened to Purusha?
Scientists have trouble talking about consciousness when you're utterly unconscious. That's why we have the word unconscious. You have sleeps,
yeah.
you have perceptions of some kind, or in fact there is no consciousness, there's just aliveness. The person in the coma is alive, and it's a slightly different
there
thing.
There's ways different categories.
Yeah.
I think you're just talking about two different
yeah.
things.
Yeah.
Talking about that innate quality of being alive, or you're talking about
yeah.
awareness.
Yeah, totally.
You're really crossing it over, like,
mm.
much. And scientists are going to study, consciousness, they're going to study the awareness, the non-awareness, and try and develop situations where the person's aware,
mm-hmm.
not aware,
mm.
and look at the difference. Assuming that people are capable of being into those two different states. But if you start talking about what you start talking about consciousness as something that is beyond awareness, then it's inaccessible. And you have to do it in the same way that you talk about electrons, you can only see the repercussions of electrons or atoms, see evidence they've been there, and there's a convenient thing that causes those things, then that's really the only approach you're going to be able to have to approaching that. Not awareness you can certainly study, but anything but beyond that, you can only look at the repercussions of it, such as like if you look at say our awareness or comes from that innate being of life or that innate quality of being life. Then you can look at awareness as a repercussion of that consciousness. But at the same time, that doesn't invalidate looking at these different things that result from consciousness as looking as evidence for, or looking at the repercussions of it, of the way it manifests in you. It doesn't invalidate that as a method of looking at what qualities of consciousness are.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that's
yeah.
totally valid. I think
right.
scientists
yeah.
are...
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Have the tools to do that.
Definitely. Yeah.
I come back to your first question a bit, which is so what, really?
Mm.
This conversation eternally fascinates me between sort of science and religion, and yet at the same time, I can't help feeling that people are just trying to catch God in a butterfly net, really. And I wonder what you expect will be the outcome. Of identifying these things, you know, do you have some expectation that people will then engage more in spiritual practice? You know, will it have a measurable effect on humankind? And cynically, I would probably say no.
Mm.
I would say that probably that knowing that we have a soul empirically. I'm not sure if it'll make much difference to the way we carry on.
Hmm.
I like the idea.
Okay. I think it would make a difference to me.
There's also I'm not so much interested in that, and I agree that it's a bit of a red herring, but what I'm interested in is if we're asking a question like what is consciousness, is examining as many sort of vectors as possible and seeing if and when they intersect, how they intersect, and if we're trying to like actually get it at truth in the philosophical sense, that is to say, not just we don't know what the answer to the question is, but let's see what the neurologists have to say and the cognitive scientists and the philosophers and the theologians and everybody who has really thought about the question in depth might have something to offer. And you may find that one of those vectors will just go off like that and not intersect, and then maybe we can dispense with it. But for me, I do find value in comparing the fairly complex Shaiva theological views on consciousness with cognitive mm-hmm. science, for example. Mm-hmm. They can illuminate each other. I don't care if they can prove each other, mm-hmm. but if they can just help us understand more, then that seems worthwhile.
Yeah. I think maybe we could conclude now, since everyone's leaving.
Yes.
yeah.
I certainly look forward to hearing what the Shaiva views, which seem to me quite analytically sophisticated in terms of dividing up the different facets of what constitutes consciousness, its contents, its structure, etc., what they're going to have to say that will make me feel more comfortable. So thank you, everybody. Really, really interesting. Please come back next week.
Okay.
When it will be?
Yeah.
Is it you next week?
Is it? Yeah.
I don't know.
Nobody can remember.
Oh my God.
It is.
I wonder who Mr. Shiva was, and I found out.
Now we know.
Thank you, Jonathan.
Thank you.